This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Pilot's Wife, written by Anita Shreve, read by Melanie Griffith.
For Christopher. This is an entirely fictional story about a woman whose husband goes down with his plane. The characters are not drawn from life and do not resemble anyone I know or have ever heard about. I would like to thank the following people at Little, Brown & Company, my editor, Michael Peach, for his sharp eye, his love of editing, and his quiet wisdom, my publicist, Jen Marshall, for the ease with which she appears to be able to solve any problem that comes her way, and Betsy Urig for the clarity and care she brought to the task of copy editing this book. I would like to thank as well my daughter, Catherine Clemens, for helping to shape the portrait of Maddie, Alan Sampson of Little Brown & Company, UK, for reading the manuscript and for his continuing support, and Gary DeLong for sharing with me details about the harsh reality of the grieving process. As ever, I am grateful to John Osborne, who always has first look at any manuscript and who consistently manages to steer me ever so gently in the right direction. And finally, though certainly not least, indeed she is the linchpin of all my books, I would like to thank my agent and friend Ginger Barber for her excellent criticism and unwavering graciousness. 1. She heard a knocking and then a dog barking. Her dream left her, skittering behind a closing door. It had been a good dream, warm and close, and she minded. She fought the waking. It was dark in the small bedroom, with no light yet behind the shades. She reached for the lamp, fumbled her way up the brass, and she was thinking, what? What? The lit room alarmed her, the wrongness of it, like an emergency room at midnight. She thought in quick succession, Maddie, then Jack, then neighbor, then car accident. But Maddie was in bed, wasn't she? Catherine had seen her to bed, had watched her walk down the hall and through a door, the door shutting with a firmness that was just short of a slam. Enough to make a statement, but not provoke a reprimand. And Jack, where was Jack? She scratched the sides of her head, raking out her sleep-flattened hair. Jack was where? She tried to remember the schedule. London. Due home around lunchtime, she was certain. Or did she have it wrong and had he forgotten his keys again? She sat up and put her feet on the freezing floorboards. She had never understood why the wood of an old house lost its warmth so completely in the winter. Her black leggings had ridden up to the middle of her calves, and the cuffs of the shirt she had slept in, a worn white shirt of Jack's, had unrolled and were hanging past the tips of her fingers. She couldn't hear the knocking anymore, and she thought for a few seconds that she had imagined it. Had dreamed it, in the way she sometimes had dreams from which she woke into other dreams. She reached for the small clock on her bedside table and looked at it. 3:24. She peered more closely at the black face with the glow-in-the-dark dial, and then set the clock down on the marble top of the table so hard that the case popped open and a battery rolled under the bed. But Jack was in London, she told herself again. And Maddie was in bed. There was another knock then, three sharp raps on glass. A small stoppage in her chest traveled down into her stomach and lay there. In the distance, the dog started up again with short, brittle yips. She took careful steps across the floor, as if moving too fast might set something in motion that hadn't yet begun. She opened the latch of the bedroom door with a soft click, and made her way down the back staircase. She was thinking that her daughter was upstairs and that she should be careful. She walked through the kitchen and tried to see through the window over the sink into the driveway that wound around to the back of the house. She could just make out the shape of an ordinary dark car. She turned the corner into the narrow back hallway, where the tiles were worse than the floorboards, ice on the soles of her feet. She flipped on the back door light and saw, beyond the small pane set into the top of the door, a man. He tried not to look surprised by the sudden light. He moved his head slowly to the side, not staring into the glass, as if it were not a polite thing to do, as if he had all the time in the world, as if it were not 3:24 in the morning. He looked pale in the glare of the light. He had hooded eyelids and a widow's peak, hair the color of dust that had been cut short and brushed back at the sides. His topcoat collar was turned up, and his shoulders were hunched. He moved once quickly on the doorstep, stamping his feet. She made a judgment then, the long face, slightly sad, decent clothes, an interesting mouth, the bottom lip slightly curved and fuller than the upper lip, not dangerous. As she reached for the knob, she thought, not a burglar, not a rapist, definitely not a rapist. She opened the door. "Mrs. Lyons," he asked. And then she knew. It was in the way he said her name, the fact that he knew her name at all. It was in his eyes, a wary flicker, the quick breath he took. She snapped away from him and bent over at the waist. She put a hand to her chest. He reached his hand through the doorway and touched her at the small of her back. The touch made her flinch. She tried to straighten up but couldn't. "When?" she asked. He took a step into her house and closed the door. "Earlier this morning," he said.
"Where?"
"About 10 miles off the coast of Ireland."
"In the water?"
"No, in the air."
"Oh."
She brought a hand to her mouth. "It almost certainly was an explosion," he said quickly. "You sure it was Jack?" He glanced away and then back again. "Yes." He caught her elbows as she went down. She was momentarily embarrassed, but she couldn't help it. Her legs were gone. She hadn't known that her body could abandon her so, could just give out like that. He held her elbows, but she wanted her arms back. Gently, he lowered her to the floor. She bent her face to her knees and wrapped her arms over her head. Inside her, there was a white noise, and she couldn't hear what he was saying. Consciously, she tried to breathe, to fill up her lungs. She raised her head up and took in great gulps of air. As if in the distance, she heard an odd choking sound that wasn't exactly crying because her face was dry. From behind her, the man was trying to lift her up. "Let me get you to a chair," he said. She swung her head from side to side. She wanted him to let her go. She wanted to sink into the tiles, to ooze onto the floor. Awkwardly, he placed his arms under hers. She let him help her up. "I'm going to be," she said. Quickly, she pushed him away with the palms of her hands and leaned against the wall for support. She coughed and gagged, but there was nothing in her stomach. When she looked up, she could see that he was apprehensive. He took her by the arm and made her round the corner into the kitchen. "Sit here in this chair," he said. "Where's the light?"
"On the wall."
Her voice was raspy and faint. She realized she was shivering. He swiped for the switch and found it. She put a hand up in front of her face to ward off the light. Instinctively, she did not want to be seen. "Where do you keep the glasses?" he asked. She pointed to a cabinet. He poured her a glass of water and handed it to her, but she couldn't hold it steady. He braced her fingers while she took a sip. "You're in shock," he said. "Where can I get you a blanket?"
"You're with the airline," she said.
He took off his top coat and his jacket and put the jacket around her shoulders. He made her slide her arms into the sleeves, which were surprisingly silky and warm. "No," he said. "The Union." She nodded slowly, trying to make sense of this. "Robert Hart," he said, introducing himself. She nodded again, took another sip of water. Her throat felt dry and sore. I'm here to help, he said. This is going to be difficult to get through. Is your daughter here? You know I have a daughter? She asked quickly. And then she thought, of course you do. Would you like me to tell her? He asked. Catherine shook her head. They always said the union would get here first, she said. The wives, I mean. Do I have to wake her now? He glanced quickly at his watch, then at Catherine, as if considering how much time was left to them. In a few minutes, he said. When you're ready, take your time. The telephone rang, a serrated edge in the silence of the kitchen. Robert Hart answered it immediately. No comment, he said. No comment. No comment. No comment. She watched him lay the receiver back on its cradle and massage his forehead with his fingers. He had thick fingers and large hands, hands that seemed too big for his body. She looked at the man's shirt, a white Oxford with a gray stripe, but all she could see was a fake plane in a fake sky blowing itself to bits in the distance. She wanted the man from the union to turn around and tell her that he had made a mistake. He had gotten the plane wrong. She was the wrong wife. It hadn't happened the way he said it had. She could almost feel the joy of that. Is there someone you want me to call? He asked. To be with you? No, she said. Yes. She paused. No. She shook her head. She wasn't ready yet. She lowered her eyes and fixed them on the cabinet under the sink. What was in it? Cascade, Drano, Pine Sol, Jack's black shoe polish. She bit the inside of her cheek and looked around at the kitchen, at the cracked pine table, the stained hearth behind it, the milk green Hoosier cabinet. Her husband had shined his shoes in this room not 2 days ago, his foot braced on a bread drawer he had pulled out for the task. It was often the last thing he did before he left for work. She would sit and watch him from the chair, and lately it had become a kind of ritual, a part of his leaving her. It had always been hard for her, his leaving the house. No matter how much work she had to do, no matter how much she looked forward to having time to herself. And it wasn't that she had been afraid. She hadn't been in the habit of being fearful. Safer than driving a car, he'd always said, and he'd had an offhand confidence, as though his safety were not even worthy of a conversation. No, it wasn't exactly safety. It was the act of leaving itself, of Jack's removing himself from the house, that had always been difficult. She often felt, watching him walk out of the door with his thick, boxy flight bag in one hand and his overnight bag in the other, his uniform cap tucked under his arm, that he was, in some profound way, separating from her. And, of course, he was. He was leaving her in order to take a 170-ton airplane into the air and across the ocean to London or to Amsterdam or to Nairobi. It wasn't a particularly hard feeling to sort out, and within moments it would pass. Sometimes Catherine would become so accustomed to his absence that she bristled at the change in her routines when he returned. And then, 3 or 4 days later, the cycle would begin again. She didn't think Jack had ever felt the coming and going in quite the same way she had. To leave, after all, was not the same as being left. I'm just a glorified bus driver, he used to say. And not all that glorified, he would add. Used to say. She tried to take it in. She tried to understand that Jack no longer existed. But all she could see were cartoon puffs of smoke, lines drawn outward in all directions. She let the image go as quickly as it had come. Mrs. Lyons, is there a television in another room that I could keep half an eye on? Robert Hart asked. In the front room, she said, pointing. I just need to hear what they're reporting now. It's fine, she said. I'm fine. He nodded, but he seemed reluctant. She watched him leave the room. She shut her eyes and thought, I absolutely cannot tell Maddie. Already she could imagine how it would be. She would open the door to Maddie's room, and on the wall there would be posters of Less Than Jake and extreme skiing in Colorado. On the floor would be 2 or 3 days' worth of inside-out clothes. Maddie's sports equipment would be propped up in a corner, her skis and poles, her snowboard, her field hockey and lacrosse sticks. Her bulletin board would be covered with cartoons and pictures of her friends, Taylor, Alyssa, and Kara, 15-year-old girls with ponytails and long hair wisps in the front. Maddie would be huddled under her blue and white comforter and would pretend not to hear her until Catherine said her name for the third time. Then Maddie would bolt upright, at first irritated to be woken, thinking it was time for school and wondering why Catherine had moved into the room. Maddie's hair, a sandy red with metallic threads, would be spread along the shoulders of a purple t-shirt that said Ely Lacrosse in white letters across her tiny breasts. She would put her hands behind her on the mattress and hold herself up. What is it, Mom? She would say, like that. What is it, Mom? And then again, her voice instantly more high-pitched. Mom, what is it? And Catherine would have to kneel beside the bed and would have to tell her daughter what had happened. No, Mom, Maddie would cry. No, Mom. When Catherine opened her eyes, she could hear the low murmur of the television. She got up from the kitchen chair and walked into the long front room with its 6 pairs of floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the lawn and the water. There was a Christmas tree in the corner that had stopped her at the threshold. Robert Hart was hunched forward on the sofa, and an old man was being interviewed on the TV. She had missed the beginning of the report. It was CNN or maybe CBS. Robert looked quickly over at her. Are you sure you want to watch this? He asked. Please, she said. I'd rather see. She entered the room and moved closer to the television. It was raining where the old man was, and later they printed the name of the place along the bottom of the screen. Malinhead, Ireland. She couldn't picture where it might be on a map. She didn't even know which Ireland it was in. Rain dripped from the old man's cheeks, and he had long white pouches under his eyes. The camera moved away and showed a village green with pristine white facades of buildings fronting it. In the center of the row of buildings was a sad-looking hotel, and she read the name along a thin marquee, Malin Hotel. There were men standing around its doorway with mugs of tea or coffee in their hands, looking over in a shy way at all the news crews. The camera slid back to the old man and moved in close to his face. He looked shocky around the eyes, and his mouth was hanging open, as though it was hard for him to breathe. Catherine watched him on the television and she thought, that is what I look like now, gray in the face, the eyes staring out at something that isn't even there, the mouth loose like that of a hooked fish. The interviewer, a dark-haired woman with a black umbrella, asked the old man to describe what he had seen. It were moonlight with dark water, he said haltingly. His voice was hoarse, his accent so thick they had to print what he was saying at the bottom of the screen. There were bits of silver falling from the sky and landing all around the boat, he said. The bits fluttered like birds, birds that were wounded, falling downward, spiraling like and spinning. She walked to the TV and knelt on the carpet so that her face was even with the old man's on the screen. The fisherman was waving his hands around to show what he meant. He made a cone shape and moved his fingers up and down and then drew a ragged edge. He told the interviewer that none of the strange bits had actually landed in his boat, and that by the time he had motored to the places where it seemed the things had fallen, they had disappeared or sunk into the sea, and he could not get at them, not even with his nets. Facing the camera, the reporter said that the man's name was Eamon Gilley. He was 83, she said, and he was the first eyewitness to come forward. No one else appeared to have seen what the fishermen had seen, and nothing had been confirmed yet. Catherine had the feeling that the reporter wanted very much for Gilley's story to be true, but felt obliged to say that it might not be. But Catherine knew that it was true. She could see the moonlight on the sea, the way it must have twitched and sparkled, the silvery glints falling from the sky, falling like tiny angels coming down to earth. She could see the small boat in the water and the fisherman standing at its bow, his face turned upward toward the moon, his hands outstretched. She could see him risk his balance to catch the fluttering bits, poking the air like a small child grabbing for fireflies on a summer night. And she thought then how strange it was that disaster, the sort of disaster that drained the blood from your body and took the air out of your lungs and hit you again and again in the face, could be, at times, such a thing of beauty. Robert reached over and turned off the television. "Are you all right?" he asked. "When did you say it happened?" He rested his elbows on his knees and folded his hands. 1:57. Our time, 6:57 theirs. Above his right eyebrow there was a scar. He must be in his late 30s, she thought, closer to her age than to Jack's. He had the fair skin of a blonde and brown eyes with flecks of rust in the irises. Jack had had blue eyes, two different blues. One a washed-out blue, almost translucent, a watercolor sky. The other brilliant, a sharp royal. The unusual coloring drew others' eyes to his, made people examine his face as though this asymmetrical characteristic suggested imbalance, perhaps something wrong. She thought, is this the man's job? That was the time of the last transmission, the man from the union said in a voice she could hardly hear. What was the last transmission? She asked. It was routine. She didn't believe him. What was routine about a last transmission? Do you know, she asked, what the most common last words are from a pilot when he knows he's going down? Well, of course you know. Mrs. Lyons, he said, turning to her. Catherine, you're still in shock. You should have some sugar. Is there juice? In the fridge. It was a bomb, wasn't it? I wish I had more to tell you. He stood up and walked into the kitchen. She realized that she didn't want to be left alone in a room just yet, and so she followed him. She looked at the clock over the sink. 3:38. Was it possible that only 14 minutes had elapsed since she had peered at the clock on the night table upstairs? You got here fast, she said, sitting again on the kitchen chair. He poured orange juice into a glass. How did you do it? She asked. We have a plane, he said quietly. No, I mean, tell me, how is it done? You have a plane waiting? You sit around waiting for a crash? He handed her the glass of juice. He leaned against the sink and ran the middle finger of his right hand vertically along his brow, from the bridge of his nose to his hairline. He seemed to be making decisions then, judgments. No, I don't, he said. I don't sit around waiting for a crash. But if one occurs, we have procedures in place. We have a Learjet at Washington National. It flies me to the nearest major airport, in this case, Portsmouth. And then there's a car waiting. And you did it in... She calculated the time it would take him to travel from Washington, which is where the Union headquarters was, to Ely, New Hampshire, just over the Massachusetts border. A little over an hour, he said. But why? She asked. To get here first, he said. To inform you, to help you through it. That's not why, she said quickly. He thought a minute. It's part of it, he said. She smoothed her hand over the cracked surface of the pine table. On nights when Jack had been home, Jack and she and Maddie had seemed to live within a 10-foot radius of that table, reading the paper, listening to the news, cooking, eating, cleaning up, doing homework, and then, after Maddie had gone to bed, talking or not talking, and sometimes, if Jack didn't have a trip, sharing a bottle of wine. In the beginning, when Maddie was little and early to bed, they had sometimes had candlelight and made love in the kitchen, one or the other of them seized by a sudden lust or fondness. She tilted her head back and shut her eyes. The pain seemed to stretch from her abdomen to her throat. She felt panicky, as though she had strayed too close to the edge. She drew in her breath so sharply that Robert looked over at her. And then she moved from shock to grief, the way she might enter another room. The images assaulted her, the feeling of Jack's breath at the top of her spine, as though he were whispering to her bones, the sliding sensation against her mouth when he gave her a quick kiss as he went off to work, the drape of his arm around Maddie after her last field hockey game, when Maddie was sticky and sweaty and crying because her team had lost 8-0, the pale skin on the inside of Jack's arms, the slightly pitted skin between his shoulder blades, a legacy of adolescence, the odd tenderness of his feet, the way he couldn't walk along a beach without sneakers, the warmth of him always, even on the coldest of nights, as though his inner furnace burned extravagantly. The images pushed and jostled and competed rudely with each other for space. She tried to stop them, but she couldn't. The man from the Union stood at the sink and watched her. He didn't move. I loved him, she said when she could speak. She got up and ripped a sheet of paper towel from its holder. She blew her nose. She felt a momentary bewilderment of tenses. She wondered if time were opening up an envelope and would swallow her for a day or a week or a month or possibly forever. I know, said Robert. Are you married? She asked, sitting down again. He put his hands in the pockets of his trousers and jiggled the change there. He had on gray suit trousers. Jack hardly ever wore a suit. Like many men who wore a uniform to work, he had never been a particularly good dresser. No, he said, I'm divorced. Do you have children? 2 boys, 9 and 6. Do they live with you? With my wife in Alexandria, ex-wife. Do you see them much? I try. Why did you get divorced? I stopped drinking, he said. He said this matter-of-factly, without explanation. She wasn't sure she understood. She blew her nose again. I have to call the school, she said. I'm a teacher. That can wait, he said. No one will be there anyway. No one is awake yet. He looked at his watch. Tell me about your job, she said. Well, there isn't a lot to tell. It's mostly public relations. How many of these things have you had to do? She asked. Things? Crashes, she said. Crashes. He was silent for a minute. 5, he said finally. 5 major ones. 5? And 4 smaller ones. Tell me about them, she said. He glanced out the window. 30 seconds passed, maybe a minute. Again, she sensed that he was making judgments, decisions. Once I got to the widow's house, he said, and I found her in bed with another man. Where was this? Westport, Connecticut. What happened? The wife came down in a robe, and I told her, and then the man got dressed and came down. He was a neighbor. And then he and I stood in the woman's kitchen and watched her collapse. It was a mess. Did you know him? Catherine asked. My husband? No, he said. I'm sorry. He was older than you. I know. What else did they tell you about him? 11 years with Vision. Before that, Santa Fe, 5 years. Before that, Teterboro, 2 years. 2 years Vietnam, DC-3 gunships. Born in Boston. College Holy Cross. One child, a daughter, 15. A wife. He thought a minute. Tall, he said. 6'4"? Fit. She nodded. Good record. Excellent record, actually. He scratched the back of one hand with the other. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry I know these facts about your husband, yet didn't know him at all. Did they tell you anything about me? Only that you're 15 years younger than your husband, and that you'd be here with your daughter. She examined her feet, which were small and white, as if the blood had left them. The soles weren't clean. How many were on board? She asked. 104. Not full, she said. Not full, no. Any survivors? They're searching. Other images intruded now. A moment of knowledge. What knowledge? In the cockpit. Jack's hands at the controls. A body spinning in the air. No, not even a body. She shook her head roughly. I have to tell her alone, she said. He nodded quickly as if that were already understood. No, she said, I mean, you have to leave the house. I don't want anyone to see this or hear this. I'll sit in my car, he said. She slipped off the jacket he had given her. The telephone rang again, but neither of them moved. In the distance, they could hear the answering machine click on. She wasn't prepared for Jack's voice, deep and amiable, a hint of Boston in the vowels, with its familiar message. She put her face into her hands and waited for the message to be over. When she looked up, she saw that Robert had been studying her. He glanced away. It's to keep me from talking to the press, isn't it? She said. That's why you're here. A car rolled into the driveway and crunched on the gravel. The man from the union looked out the window, took the jacket from her, and put it on. It's so I won't say anything that might make them think pilot error, she said. You don't want them to think pilot error. He lifted the telephone receiver off its hook and laid it on the counter. Lately, Jack and she had hardly ever made love in the kitchen. They had told themselves that Maddie was older now and might come down to the kitchen looking for a snack. Most nights, after Maddie had gone up to her room to listen to her CDs or to talk on the phone, they had just sat at the table reading magazines, too exhausted to put away the dishes or even to talk. I'll tell her now, she said. He hesitated. You understand we can't stay out there long, he said. They're from the airline, aren't they? She asked, looking through the kitchen window. In the driveway, she could just make out two shadowy shapes emerging from a car. She walked toward the bottom of the stairs. She looked up the steep incline. There were 500 steps, at least 500. They stretched on and on. She understood that something had been set in motion and was beginning now. She was not sure she had the stamina to make it to the top. She looked at the man from the union, who was moving through the kitchen to answer the door. Mom, she said, and he turned. What they usually say is Mom. The glare of the sun, reflected from the occasional passing car, moves along the back wall of the shop like a slow strobe. The shop seems airless today, suffocating in the heat, the air thick with dust motes floating in the shafts of light. She stands with a rag in her hand inside a maze of mahogany and walnut tables, of lamps and old linens, of books that smell of mildew. She glances up at him as he walks in. She has a brief impression of someone official on an errand, of someone lost and looking for directions. He has on a white shirt with short sleeves that stick out from his shoulders like thin white flags, heavy navy blue trousers. He wears old man's shoes, black shoes that are weighty and enormous. "We're closed," she says. He looks quickly behind him and sees the open sign on the inside of the door. He scratches the back of his neck. "Sorry," he says and turns to leave. She has always marveled at the speed with which the mind makes judgments, a second, 2 seconds at the most, even before anyone has moved or said a word. Early 30s, she guesses, not stocky exactly, but large. He has broad shoulders, and she thinks at once that there is nothing anemic about him. She is struck initially by his jawline, which is rectangular and smooth, and by his somewhat comical ears, which stick out at their tops. She thinks there might be something wrong with his eyes. "I'm taking inventory, but if there's something that you're looking for, that's fine," she says. He moves into a tube of sunlight that comes from a round window over the door. She can see his face clearly. There are tiny wrinkles at the corners of his eyes, and he doesn't have perfect teeth. His hair is cut short, a military cut, dark, almost black, and would be curly if it had any length. There is a dent in his hair, as if he had a cap on earlier. He puts his hands into his trouser pockets. He asks her if she has any old checkerboards. "Yes," she says. She begins to walk through the maze to a far wall, apologizing for the mess as she goes. She is aware of him behind her, aware of her gait and posture, which suddenly seem unnatural, too stiff. She has on jeans, a red tank top, and a pair of old leather sandals. Her hair is loose and sticky on the back of her neck. She feels as though the heat and the humidity, combined with the dust she has been kicking up, have created a kind of dirty film all over her. In the mosaic of her reflection in an antique mirror on the wall, she catches a glimpse of soggy tendrils of hair on either side of her face, which is shiny with perspiration. Her bra strap is showing, a white flash under the red, and there is a blue stain on the tank top from something that bled in the wash. The board is lying against the wall with several old paintings. The man moves in front of her and crouches to get a better look. She can see the strength of him in his thighs, the length of his back in the crouch, the place where the belt dips in the back with the strain. She notices the white epaulets on his shoulders. "What's this?" he asks, his eye caught by a painting beside the checkerboard. It is a landscape, an impressionistic rendering of a hotel out at the Isles of Shoals. The hotel is old, 19th century, with deep porches and a long, smooth lawn in the middle of a rocky seascape. He stands and shows her the painting, which she has never paid much attention to before. "This is pretty good," he says. "Who's the artist?" She tilts her head and reads from the back of the painting. "Claude Lény," she says, 1890. It says here that it came from an estate sale in Portsmouth. "It's like a Child Hassam," he says. She doesn't respond. She doesn't know who Child Hassam is. He traces the wooden frame with his fingers, and it seems to her as though someone were trailing his fingers up and down her spine. "How much is it?" he asks. "I'll look it up," she says. They walk together to the register. The price, when she finds it, seems staggeringly high. She feels embarrassed to name such a sum, but it is not her shop, and she should try to make the sale for her grandmother. When she tells him the price, he doesn't even blink. "I'll take it," he says. He gives her cash, and she hands him a receipt, which he sticks absent-mindedly in his shirt pocket. She wonders what he does in the military, why he isn't at his base on a Wednesday afternoon. "What do you do?" she asks, looking again at the epaulets on his shoulders. "Cargo transport," he says. "I have a layover. I borrow a car from a ticket agent at the airport and go for drives." "You fly," she says, stating the obvious. "I'm like a truck driver, only it's a plane," he says, looking at her intently. "What's in the plane?" she asks. "Canceled checks." Canceled checks? She laughs. She tries to imagine an entire plane filled with canceled checks. Nice shop, he says, looking around. It's my grandmother's. She crosses her arms over her chest. Your eyes are two different colors, she says. It's genetic. It's from my father's side of the family. He pauses. The eyes are both real, in case you wanted to know. I did, as a matter of fact. Your hair is beautiful, he says. It's genetic, she says. He nods his head and smiles, as if to say, touché. It's what color, he asks? Red. No, I mean, it depends on the light. How old are you? 18. He seems surprised, taken aback. Why? She asks. How old are you? 33. I thought. Thought what? That you were older, I don't know. It lies there between them, the age difference, the 15 years. Look, he says. Look, she says. He puts a hand on the register. I was born in Boston, he says, and grew up in Chelsea, which is a part of Boston you don't want to know about. I went to Boston Latin and to Holy Cross. My mother died when I was 9, and my father had a heart attack when I was in college. I had a low lottery number and was drafted and learned to fly in Vietnam. I don't currently have a girlfriend, and I've never been married. I have a one-bedroom condo in Teterboro. It's too small, and I'm hardly ever... Stop, she says. I want to get this part over with. She understands then, in a way she has seldom been allowed to know such things in her 18 years, that she holds it all in her hand at that moment, that she can wrap her fingers around it and grasp it tightly and never let it go. Or she can open her hand, lay open her palm, and give it away. Just give it away, as simply as that. I know where Chelsea is, she says. 10 seconds pass, maybe 20. They stand in the hot gloom of the shop, neither of them speaking. She knows he wants to touch her. She can feel the heat from his skin even across the counter. She draws in her breath slowly and evenly so as not to attract attention to the effort. She has a nearly overwhelming desire to close her eyes. It's hot in here, he says. It's hot out there, she says. Unseasonably hot. For so early in June. You want to go for a drive? He asks. Cool off? Where? She asks. Anywhere. Just a drive. She allows herself to meet his gaze. He smiles slowly, and the smile takes her by surprise. They drive to the beach and go swimming in their clothes. The water is frigid, but the air is hot, and that contrast is delicious. Jack ruins his uniform and later has to borrow another. When she comes out of the water, he is standing with his hands in his pockets and a blanket rolled under his arm. His clothes are soaked and hanging off him, and his shirt has gone a translucent flesh color. They lie on the blanket on the sand. She shivers against his wet shirt. He keeps the fingers of his left hand anchored, knotted in her hair, as he kisses her and moves his right hand under the tank top and along the flat of her stomach. She feels loose, loose-limbed and opened up, as though someone had just tugged at a thread and was unraveling her. She covers his hand with her own. His is oddly warm and rough and sandy and abrasive. She feels happy. It is a pure and undiluted happiness. It is all beginning, and she knows it. Even before Catherine reached the top of the stairs, she could hear Maddie walking into the bathroom. Her daughter's hair had a lovely natural curl, but each morning Maddie would get up to wash her hair and painstakingly blow-dry it to straighten it. It always seemed to Catherine that Maddie was trying to subdue her hair, as though wrestling with a part of herself that had emerged not long ago. Catherine was waiting for Maddie to outgrow this stage and had been thinking that any day now her daughter would wake up and let her hair go natural. Then Catherine would know that Maddie was all right. Maddie had probably heard the cars in the driveway, Catherine thought. Perhaps she had heard the voices in the kitchen, too. Maddie was used to waking up in the dark, particularly in the winter. She knew she had to get Maddie out of the bathroom. Already, she was thinking that it was not a safe place to tell her daughter. She stood outside the door. Maddie had turned on the shower. Catherine could hear her undressing. Catherine knocked. Maddie, she said. What? I need to talk to you. Mom! The way Maddie said it, in that familiar sing-song tone, as if annoyed already. I can't, she said. I'm having a shower. Maddie, it's important. What? The bathroom door opened abruptly. Maddie had a green towel wrapped around her. My lovely, beautiful daughter, Catherine thought. How can I possibly do this to her? Catherine's hands began to shake. She crossed her arms over her chest and tucked her hands under her armpits. Put on a robe, Maddie, Catherine said, feeling herself beginning to cry. She never cried in front of Maddie. I need to talk to you. It's important. Maddie slipped her robe off the hook and put it on, stunned into obedience. What is it, Mom? A child's mind couldn't take it in, Catherine decided later. A child's body couldn't absorb such grotesque facts. Maddie flung herself down onto the floor as if she had been shot. She flailed her arms furiously all around her head, and Catherine thought of bees. She tried to seize Maddie's arms and hold tightly onto her, but Maddie threw her off and ran. She was out of the house and halfway down the lawn before Catherine caught her. Maddie, 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 Catherine said when she had reached her. Over and over. Maddie, Maddie, Maddie. Catherine put her hands behind Maddie's head and pressed her face close to her own, pressed it in hard, as though to tell her she must listen. She had no choice. I will take care of you, Catherine said. And then again. Listen to me, Maddie. I will take care of you. Catherine folded her daughter into her arms. There was frost at their feet. Maddie was crying now, and Catherine thought her own heart would break. But this was better, she knew. This was better. Catherine helped Maddie into the house and made her lie down on the couch. She wrapped her daughter in blankets and held on to her and rubbed her arms and legs to stop the shivering. Robert tried to give Maddie some water, which made her gag. Julia, Catherine's grandmother, the woman who had raised her, was called. Catherine was vaguely aware of other people in the house then, a man and a woman with suits on, standing at the kitchen counter, waiting. She could hear Robert talking on the telephone and then murmuring with the people from the airline. She hadn't realized that a television was on, but Maddie suddenly sat up and looked at her. Did they say a bomb? Maddie asked. And then Catherine heard the bulletin, in retrospect, the way one realizes that subliminally all the words have been heard and are there in the mind just waiting to be called forth. Later, Catherine would come to think of the bulletins as bullets, word bullets that tore into the brain and exploded, obliterating memories. Robert, she called. He came into the living room and stood next to her. It's not confirmed, he said. They think a bomb? It's just a theory. Give her one of these. What is it? It's a Valium. You carry these, she asked, with you? Julia moved through the house with the stolid presence of a relief worker in an emergency zone, disrespectful toward death and seemingly unwilling to be cowed. With her matronly bulk and poodle perm, her only concession to age, she had Maddie off the couch and upstairs within minutes. When Julia was certain that Maddie could stand up by herself in a room alone and pull on a pair of jeans, she came back downstairs to attend to her granddaughter. She stood in the kitchen and made a pot of strong tea. She laced it generously with brandy from a bottle she had brought with her. She told the woman from the airline to be sure that Catherine drank it down, at least one mug. Then Julia went back up to Maddie and made the girl wash her face. By then, the Valium was kicking in, and except for small, sudden bursts of surprise and grief, Maddie was winding down. Among other things, Catherine knew, grief was physically exhausting. Julia made Maddie lie down on her bed and then returned to the front room. Sitting beside Catherine on the couch, she peered into Catherine's cup to see how much tea she had swallowed, then told her to drink some more. She asked straight out if Catherine had any tranquilizers. Robert volunteered the Valium. Julia said, "Who are you?" And Robert told her, and then she asked him for a pill. "Take this," Julia said to Catherine. "I can't," Catherine said. "I've had the brandy." "So what? Take it." Julia didn't ask Catherine how she felt or if she was all right. In Julia's way of thinking, Catherine knew there wasn't an alternative to being a certain level of all right. Nothing else would work now. The tears, the shock, the sympathy, all of that could come later. "It's awful," Julia said. "Catherine, I know it's awful. Look at me. But the only way to the other side is through it. You know that, don't you? Nod your head." "Mrs. Lyons?" Catherine turned from the window. Rita, a small blonde woman from the chief pilot's office, was sliding her arms into her coat. "I'm going to go now to the inn." Rita, who wore oak-colored lipstick, had been in the house all day since 4 a.m, yet her face was oddly dewy, her navy blue suit barely wrinkled. The woman's partner, Jim something, also from the airline, had left the house hours ago. Catherine couldn't remember exactly when. "Robert Hart is still here," Rita said, "in the office." Catherine was studying the perfect part in Rita's straight hair with a kind of fascination. Rita, she was thinking, wore a striking resemblance to a certain newscaster on a station out of Portland. Earlier in the day, Catherine had minded the strangers in her house, but she'd quickly seen she couldn't cope alone. "You have rooms at the Tides?" Catherine asked. "Yes, we've taken several." Catherine nodded. She understood that the Tides Inn, which in the off-season was lucky to have two couples for a weekend stay, would be full now, full of the press and people from the airline. "You're all right?" Rita asked. "Yes." "Can I get you anything before I go?" "No," Catherine said. "I'm fine." It was an absurd statement, Catherine was thinking, watching Rita leave the kitchen. Laughably meaningless. She would probably never be fine again. It was not yet 4:15, but it was nearly dark already. In late December, the shadows started as soon as lunch was over, and all afternoon the light was long and stretched thin. It made soft, feathery colors she hadn't seen in months, so that nothing seemed exactly familiar anymore. Night would settle in like slow blindness, sucking the color from the trees and the low sky and the rocks and the frozen grass and the frost-white hydrangeas until there was nothing left in the window but her own reflection. She crossed her arms and leaned forward against the lip of the sink, looking out through the kitchen window. It had been a long day, a long, terrible day. A day so long and so terrible, it had hours ago passed out of any reality Catherine had ever known. She had the distinct feeling she would never sleep again, that when she'd woken early that morning, she had emerged from a state of being that could never be re-entered. She watched Rita walk to her car, started up, and head out the driveway. There were 4 of them in the house now, Maddie asleep in her room, with Julia and Catherine taking turns watching over her, and Robert, Rita had said, was in Jack's office. Doing what? Catherine wondered. All day, down the long gravel drive and behind the wooden gate, there had been people looking in and other people keeping them away. But now, Catherine imagined, the reporters and cameramen and producers and makeup artists were probably all headed over to the Tides Inn to have a drink, tell stories, discuss the rumors, have dinner, and sleep. Wasn't this just the end of a normal workday for them? Catherine heard on the stairs a heavy tread, a man's tread, and for a moment she thought it was Jack coming down to the kitchen. But then she remembered almost immediately that it couldn't be Jack. It wasn't Jack at all. Catherine. The tie was gone, the cuffs of his shirt rolled, the top button of his shirt open. Already she had noticed that Robert Hart had a nervous habit of holding his pen between the knuckles of his fingers and flipping it back and forth like a baton. "I thought you should know," Robert said. "They're saying mechanical failure." "Who's saying mechanical failure?" "London." "They know?" "No, it's just bullshit at this point. They're guessing. They found a piece of the fuselage and an engine." "Oh," she said. She combed her hair with her fingers. It was her own nervous habit. "A piece of the fuselage," she thought. She repeated the phrase in her mind. She tried to see the piece of the fuselage to imagine what it might be. "What piece of the fuselage?" she asked. "The cabin, about 20 feet. Any..." "No." "You haven't eaten all day, have you?" he asked. "It's all right." "No, it's not all right." She looked over at the table, which was covered with dishes of food, casseroles, pies, entire dinners in separately marked plastic containers, brownies, cakes, cookies, salads. It would take a large family days to eat all of that. "It's what people do," she said. "They don't know what else to do, so they bring food." Throughout the day, individual policemen had periodically walked the length of the driveway carrying yet another offering. Catherine understood this custom, had seen it happen over and over again when there was a death in a family. But it amazed her the way the body kept moving forward, past the shock and the grief, past the retching and the hollowness inside, and kept wanting sustenance, kept wanting to be fed. It seemed unsuitable, like wanting sex. "We should have sent it back out to the end of the drive," Catherine said, "to the police and the press. It'll just go to waste in here." "Never feed the press," Robert said quickly. "They're like dogs looking for affection. They're hungry to be let inside the house." Catherine smiled, and it shocked her that she could smile. Her face hurt, the dryness and the salt of the crying. "Well, I'll be heading out now," he said, unrolling his shirt sleeves and buttoning his cuffs. "You probably want to be alone with your family." Catherine wasn't at all sure she wanted to be alone. "You're going back to Washington?" "No, I'm staying at the inn. I'll stop by tomorrow before I go." He reached for his jacket on the back of a chair and put it on. He took his tie out of the pocket. "Oh," she said vaguely. "Good." He slid his tie through his collar. "So," he said when he had knotted the tie. He gave it a small tug. The phone rang. It seemed too loud in the kitchen, too abrasive, too intrusive. She looked at it helplessly. "Robert, I can't," she said. He walked over to the telephone and answered it. "Robert Hart," he said. "No comment," he said. "Not as yet," he said. "No comment." When he hung up, Catherine started to speak.